Welcome to this Uvula audio production of Aunts Are Not Gentlemen by P.G. Wodehouse. Volume 5, Chapter 16.
Anybody not in possession of the facts would probably have been appalled at my rashness in placing myself within disemboweling range of Order Porter, feeling that I was tempting fate, and at about two ticks would be wishing I hadn't. But I, strong in the knowledge that Order P. had been reduced to the level of a fifth-rate power, was able to approach the coming interview in a bumps-a-daisy spirit, which might quite easily have led to my bursting into song. Although, as I had predicted, was in the bar having a gin and ginger. He lowered the beaker as I drew near, and regarded me in a squiggle-eyed manner, like a fastidious luncher observing a caterpillar in his salad.
"Oh, it's you,"
he said. I conceded this, for he was right. No argument about it. Assured that he wasn't looking squiggle-eyed at the wrong chap, he proceeded.
"What do you want?"
"A word with you."
"So you come to gloat, have you?"
"Certainly not, Porter. When you hear what I have to say, you will start skipping like the high hills. Not that I've ever seen high hills skip, or low hills for that matter. Porter, what would you say if I told you all your troubles, all the little odds and ends that are bothering you now, would be over, ere yonder sun had set?"
"It has set."
"Oh, has it? I didn't notice."
"And it's getting on for dinner time, so if you will kindly get the hell out of here."
"Not that I've spoken."
"Are you going to speak some more?"
"Lots more. Let us examine the position you and I are in calmly and in a judicial spirit. Vanessa Cook has told me she will marry me, and you are probably looking on me as a snake in the grass. Well, let me tell you that any resemblance between me and a snake in the grass is purely coincidental. I couldn't issue a nolo prosequi, could I, when she said that? Of course not. But all the while I was right hoeing, I felt I was behaving like a louse."
"You are a louse."
"No, that's where you make your error, Porter. I'm a man of sensibility, and a man of sensibility does not marry a girl who's in love with somebody else. He gives her up." He choked down his gin and ginger, as he suddenly got the gist.
"You would give her up to me?"
"Absolutely."
"But, Worcester, this is noble. I'm sorry I said you were a louse."
"Quite all right. Sort of mistake anyone can make."
"You remind me of Cyrano de Bergerac."
"Well, one has one's code." He'd been all smiles, or pretty nearly all smiles, up to this point, but now melancholia marked him for her own once again. He heaved a sigh as if he had found a dead mouse at the bottom of his tankard.
"It would be useless for you to make this sacrifice, Worcester. Vanessa would never marry me."
"Of course she would."
"You weren't there when she broke the engagement."
"My representative was. At least he was listening at the door."
"Then you know the general run of the thing."
"He gave me a full report."
"And you say she still loves me?"
"Like a ton of bricks. Love cannot be extinguished by a potty little lover's quarrel."
"Potty little lover's quarrel, my left eyeball. She called me a lily-livered poltroon, and a sleeked, timorous, cowering beastie. One wonders where she picks up such expressions. And all because I refused to go to old Cook and demand my money. I'd been to him once and asked him in the most civil of manners to cough up. And she wanted me to go again, and this time to thump the table and generally throw my weight around."
"You should, Orlo. That's just what you ought to do. What happened last time?"
"He flatly refused."
"How flatly?"
"Very flatly. And it would be the same if I went again."
He had given me the cue I wanted. I'd been wondering how best to introduce what I had in mind. I smiled one of my subtle smiles, and he asked me what I was grinning about. "Not if you select your time properly," I said. "What time was it that you made your try?"
"About 5 PM.
"Yes, as I suspected. No wonder he gave you the bum's rush. 5 PM is when a man's sunny disposition is down in its lowest brackets. Lunch wore off hours ago, and cocktails are not yet in sight. He isn't in the mood to oblige anyone about anything. Cook may be a hard-boiled egg, but dinner softens the hardest. Approach him when he is full to the brim, and you'll be surprised.
Fellows at the Drones have told me that applying after he has tucked into his evening meal, they got substantial loans out of Oofy Prosser.
Who is Oofy Prosser?
The club millionaire. A man who by daylight watches his disbursement like a hawk. Cook is probably just the same. Tails up, Porter. Get cracking. Be bloody and bold and resolute, I said, remembering a gag from that play Macbeth, which I was mentioning some while back. He was impressed, as who would not have been. His face lit up as if someone had pressed a button.
Worcester, you are right. You have shown me the way. You have made my path straight. Thank you, Worcester, old man.
Not at all, Porter, old chap.
It's an extraordinary thing. Anyone looking at you would write you off as a brainless nincompoop with about as much intelligence as a dead rabbit.
Well, thank you, Porter, old chap.
Not at all, Worcester, old man. Whereas all the time you have this amazing insight into human psychology.
Well, I have hidden depths, wouldn't you say?
You bet you have, Worcester, old horse.
And in another jiffy he was pressing a gin and ginger on me, as if we had been bosom pals for years, and the subject of my insides had never come up once between us. Returning to Wee Nook some 20 minutes later, after what had practically amounted to a love fest, I had that jolly feeling you don't often get nowadays that God was in his heaven and all is right with the world, as the fellow said. I counted my blessings one by one and found the sum total most satisfactory. All was quiet on the Porter front. Billy Graham was even now returning the cat to its little circle at Eggersford Court. Porter and Vanessa Cook would soon be sweethearts again, and if my popularity with Pop Cook was at a low ebb, rendering unlikely any chance of a present from him next Christmas, that was a small flaw in the ointment. Or is it fly? I never can remember. Anyway, everything, in short, was just like Mother makes it. And it was a blithe B. Worcester who, hearing the telephone tootle, went to answer it with, as you might say, a song on his lips. It was the aged relative, and the dullest ear could have spotted that she was in something of a doodah. For some moments after we had established connection, she confined herself to gasps and gurgles, such as might have proceeded from some strong swimmer in his agony. "Hello," I said, "is something up?" In the course of this narrative, I have had the occasion to mention several hacking laughs, but for sheer rasp and explosiveness, the one that the old ancestor emitted at these words topped the lot.
"Something up?"
she boomed.
"You would say a thing like that when I'm nearly off my rocker. Has that cat been returned to the store yet?"
Billy Graham is in full control.
"You mean he hasn't started yet?"
"Yes, and come back, but unfortunately the cat followed him. So he says. Anyway, he arrived here with it in close attendance, and he has now taken it back off again. He's probably decanting the animal at this moment. But why the agitation?"
"I'll tell you why the agitation. If that cat is not back where it belongs immediately, if not sooner, ruin stares me in the eyeball. And Tom is in the worst attack of indigestion he has ever had since the time he ate all that lobster at his club. And only myself to blame."
"Did you say you were to blame?"
"Yes, why?"
"I only wondered if I heard it correctly." I've become so accustomed to being blamed for everything that goes wrong that her words had touched me deeply. You don't often find an aunt taking the rap when she has a nephew at her disposal to shove the thing onto. It's pretty universally agreed that that is what nephews are for. My voice shook a bit as I applied for further details. "What seems to be the trouble?" I asked. "Aunts as a class are seldom good listeners." She did not answer the question, but embarked on what sounded as if it was going to be a lecture on the conditions in her native land.
"I'll tell you what's wrong with England of today, Bertie. There are too many people around with scruples and high principles and all that sort of guff. You can't do the simplest thing without somebody jumping on the back of your neck because you've offended against his blasted code of ethics. You'd think a man like Jimmy Briscoe would be broad-minded, but no. He couldn't have been more puff-faced if he'd been the Archbishop of Canterbury. You probably put the blame on his brother, the vicar, but I don't agree. I can excuse him because it's his job to be finicky about things. But Jimmy, he made me feel as if I'd shot a fox or something. and it wasn't as if I was getting anything out of it. It was a pure act of kindness, because I could see he had the interests of the organ at heart, and was really worried about it. Damn it, St. Francis of Assisi would have done the same, and everyone would have said what a splendid chap he was, and what a pity there weren't more like him, whereas the way Jimmy went on.
I can see that if it was not checked with a firm hand, this would continue for a goodish time. I'm sorry if I seem slow on the uptake, Agent R, I said, but if so, put it down to the fact that you appear to me to be delirious. Your words are like the crackling of thorns under the pot, as the fellow said. What on earth do you think you're talking about?
Haven't you been listening?
I've been listening, yes, but without coming within a quarter mile of getting the gist.
Oh, heavens, I might have known I would have to tell you in words of one syllable. Here's what's happening in simple language, which even you can understand. I happened to be talking to the vicar, and he told me what a weight on his mind the church organ was, it being at its last gasp, and no money to pay the vet, because he'd already touched Jimmy for quite a bit to mend the church's roof. And if he tried to bite his ear again so soon after, there would, he said, be hell to pay. So what the devil do you do, he says. He didn't know. Well, you know me, Bertie, being a woman with a heart like butter, and always anxious to spread a little happiness as I pass by. I told him if he wanted a bit of easy money, to put his shirt on Jimmy's Simla for the big race. And I told him about the cat, just to make it quite clear to him that he would be betting on a sure thing.
But?
Put a sock in it and listen. Can't you stop talking for half a second? I know what you were going to say, that you were returning the cat. But this was before you told me. So I went ahead, fearing nothing, just thinking of the happiness I was bringing into his life. I ought to have known that a clergyman was bound to have scruples. It didn't occur to me at the time, and to cut a long story short, he went to Jimmy and spilled the beans, and Jimmy blew his top. Take that cat back where it belongs, he said, and a lot of stuff about being shocked and horrified, which wouldn't have mattered if he had confined himself to telling me what he thought of me, but he didn't. He said that if that cat wasn't back at Cook's within the hour, he would scratch Simler's nomination. Yes, sir, he said Simla would not be among those present at the starting post, which meant that bang would go the vast sum I had put on his nose.
But?
Yes, I know you had told me you were sending the cat back, but how was I to be sure that, on thinking it over and realizing what a good thing you would be passing up, you hadn't changed your mind?
I could see what she meant. A nephew with a lust for gold and lacking the Worcester play-the-game spirit might quite well have done as she said. No wonder she'd been all a doodah. It was a pleasure to set her mind at rest. It's quite all right, old ancestor. Billy Graham is already en route for the cookeries, and ought to have got there by now.
Complete with cat?
To the last drop.
Not to worry?
Not as far as Simla getting scratched is concerned.
Well, that's a weight off my mind, though it's disappointing to feel that my bit of stuff isn't on a cert.
Well, it'll teach you not to nobble horses.
Yes, there's that, I suppose.
Some further talk followed, for an aunt who has got hold of a telephone receiver does not lightly relinquish it. But eventually she rang off, and I picked up Daffodil Days and gave it a casual glance. Its contents proved even less fit for human consumption than I'd expected. I turned away with rising nausea, and was thus enabled to get a good view of Herbert Graham, who was coming in from the kitchen. The suddenness of his appearance, coupled with the fact that I had supposed him to be up at Eggersford Court, had made me bite my tongue, but in my concern I ignored the anguish. "Good Lord!" I ejaculated, if that's the word.
"Sir?"
"Haven't you gone yet? You should have been there and back by now."
"Very true, sir, but something occurred which prevented me from making the immediate start which I had intended."
"What was that? Did they keep you a long time at the bank, counting your money?" "Yes, I was being bitter, but I thought justified. Wasted, however, for he did not even wince beneath my sarcasm."
"No, sir,"
he replied.
"I bank in Brithmouth-on-Sea, and it is long past office hours. The occurrence to which I refer took place on these premises. In fact, in this very room. I had gone to the kitchen to get the cat, which I had left there, in its little basket, and I heard sounds proceeding from in here, and assumed you were not at home. I went in to investigate, fearing that a burglar might have effected an entry, and there on the floor was a human form, enveloped in a tablecloth. I raised this, and there underneath was Mr. Cook, with a picture round his neck, vociferating something chronic.
He paused, and I decided not to put him abreast. Never does to take fellows like Graham too fully into one's confidence. Wrapped in a tablecloth, was he? I said nonchalantly. I suppose chaps like Cook are bound to get wrapped up in tablecloths sooner or later.
The sight affected me most profoundly.
I bet it did. Sights like that do give one a start. But you soon got over it, right?
No, sir, I did not. And I'll tell you why. I was what you might call stupefied. It was his language that did it chiefly. As I was saying, he expressed himself in a very violent manner, and I saw it would be madness to proceed to Eggleswood Court and possibly encounter him in this dangerous mood. I'm a married man, and have others to think about. So, if you want that cat re-established in its former quarters, you'll have to get another operative to do it for you, or else nip up to the court and do it yourself.
And while I looked at him with a wild surmise, silent upon a sitting-room carpet in Maiden Eggleswood, Somerset, he withdrew. I was still gazing at the spot where he had been, and thinking how crazy I must have been to let Jeeves wander off, frittering away his time, whooping it up with aunts, when I might have known I was bound to need his advice and moral support at any moment, and it was only after a bit I realized that the telephone was ringing. It was, as I had rather expected it would be, my late father's sister, Dahlia, and it made clear immediately that she had just been hearing from Billy Graham and getting the bad news. In a moving passage in which she referred to him as a double-crossing rat, she said that he had formally refused to fulfill his sacred obligations.
"He had some extraordinary story about finding Cook in your cottage, with a picture round his neck and a tablecloth over him, and of being scared of going near him. It sounded like raving to me, Bertie."
"No, it was quite true."
"You mean he really did have the picture round his neck and the tablecloth over him?"
"Yes."
"How did he get that way?"
"Well, we had a little argument, and that is how it worked out." She snorted in a rather febrile manner.
"Are you telling me that you were responsible for the man Graham's cold feet?"
"In a measure, yes. Let me give you a brief account of the episode," I said, and did so. When I had finished, she spoke again, and her manner was almost calm.
"I might have known that if there was a chance of mucking up these very delicate negotiations, you would spring to the task. Well, as you are the cause of Graham walking out on us, you will have to take his place."
I was expecting this. Graham himself, it will be remembered, had made the same suggestion. I was resolved to discourage her from the outset. "No," I cried.
"Did you say no?"
"Yes, 1,000 times no."
"Scared, eh?"
"I'm not ashamed to admit it."
"You wouldn't be ashamed to admit practically anything. Where's your pride, Bertie? Have you forgotten your illustrious ancestors? There was a Worcester at the time of the Crusades who would have won the Battle of Joppa single-handed if he hadn't fallen off his horse."
"I dare say, but..."
"And the one in the Peninsular War. Wellington always used to say he was the best spy he ever had."
"Quite possibly, nonetheless."
"You don't want to show yourself worthy of those splendid fellows?"
"Not if it involves crossing Cook's path again."
"Well, if you won't, you won't. Poor old Tom, how he will have to suffer. And talking of Tom, I had a letter from him this morning. It was all about the superb dinner Anatole had dished up on the previous night. He was absolutely lyrical. I must give it to you to read. Apparently Anatole has struck one of those veins of perfection which French chefs do occasionally. Tom says in a postscript, 'How dear Bertie would have enjoyed this.'"
I'm pretty shrewd, and I didn't miss the hideous unspoken threat beneath her words. She was switching from the iron hand to the hand in the velvet glove, or rather the other way around, and letting me know, without being crude about it, that if I didn't allow myself to be bent to her will, she would put sanctions on me and bar me from Anatole's cooking. I made the great decision. "Say no more, old flesh and blood," I said. "I will return the cat to store. And if, while I am doing so, Cook jumps out from behind a bush and tears me into 100 fragments, what of it? It will be merely one more grave among the hills. What did you say?"
"Just my hero,"
said the aged relative.
Chapter 17.
I was more to be pitied than censured, mind you, for quailing a bit in the cirques. A touch of the wee, sleeked, timorous, cowering beastie is unavoidable when you're up against it, as I was. I remember once when I was faced with the task of defying my Aunt Agatha and stoutly refusing to put up her son Thomas at my flat for his midterm holiday from his school and take him A, to the British Museum, B, to the National Gallery, and C, to a play at the Old Vic by a bloke named Chekhov, Jeeves, in whom I had confided the uneasiness I felt when contemplating the shape of things to come, told me my agitation was quite normal.
"Between the acting of a dreadful thing and the first motion,"
he had said,
"all the interim is like a phantasma or a hideous dream. The genius and the mortal instruments are then in council, and the state of man, like to a little kingdom, suffers the nature of an insurrection."
I could have put it better myself, but I saw what he meant. At these times, your feet are bound to get chilly, and there's nothing you can do about it. I hid my tremors. A lifetime of getting socks on the jaw from the fist of fate have made Bertram Wooster's face an inscrutable mask, and no one would have suspected that I was not as calm as an oyster on the half-shell as I started out for Aylesford Court with the cat. But actually, behind those granite features, I was far from being tranquil. Indeed, you wouldn't have been wrong in saying that I was as jumpy as the above cat would have been if on hot bricks. I never know when I'm telling a tale of peril and suspense whether to charge straight ahead or whether to pause from time to time and bung in what is called atmosphere. Some prefer the first way, others the second. For the benefit of the latter, I will state that it was a nice evening, with gentle breezes blowing and stars peeping out, and the scent of growing things and all that. And then I can get down to the res. It was dark when I reached the cook premises, which suited me, for I had dark work to do. I halted the car about halfway up the drive and took the shortcut across country. My best friends would have warned me that I was asking for trouble, and they would have been right. The visibility being poor, the terrain lumpy, and the cat wriggling, it was pretty safe bet that sooner or later I would come a purler. This I did as I approached the stables. I struck a wet patch, my feet slid out from under me, the cat shot from my arms, falling to the earth I know not where, and I found myself face down in what was unquestionably mud which had been there some time and had a number of unpleasant substances thrown into it. I remember thinking as I extracted myself, it was lucky I wasn't on my way to mix in company, as that mud must have taken at least 80% off my glamour. It was not Bertram Wooster, the natty boulevardier, who started to return to the car, but one of the dregs of society, who had got his clothes off a handy scarecrow and had slept in them. I say started to return, for I had not gone more than a yard or two when something solid bumped against my leg, and I became aware that I had been joined by a dog of formidable physique, none other than the one I had exchanged civilities with at Wee Nook. I recognized him by his ears. At our former meeting, overcome by having found what he instantly recognized as one of the right sort, he had made the welkin ring in his enthusiasm. I urged him in an undertone to preserve a tactful silence now, for you never knew what minions of Pot Cook might be abroad in the night, and my presence would be difficult to explain. But there was no reasoning with him. At Wee Nook he had found the Worcester aroma roughly equivalent to Chanel No. 5, and it was as if he were trying now to assure me he was not the dog to be put off a pal just because the pal's scent had deteriorated somewhat. "It's the soul that counts," you could hear him saying to himself between barks. Well, I appreciated the compliment, of course, but I was not my usual debonair self, for I feared the worst. Barking like this, I felt, could not go unheard unless Cook's outdoor staff had been recruited entirely from deaf adders. And I was right. Somewhere off stage, a voice shouted,
"Hi!"
making it clear that Bertram, as so often before, was about to cop it amidships. I gave the dog a reproachful look. Not much good in that light, of course. I was recalling the story they used to read me in my childhood, the one about the fellow who had written a book and his dog Diamond chewed up the manuscript. The point being what a decent chap the fellow was, because all he said was, "Ah, Diamond, Diamond, you know little about what you've done." It ought to be, "Thou little knowest," and "What thou hast done," but I couldn't do the dialect. I featured the story because I was equally restrained. "I told you not to bark, you silly ass," was my only comment, and as I spoke, the shouter who had shouted "Hey!" came up. He had not made a good impression on me from the start because his voice had reminded me of the sergeant major who used to come twice a week to drill us at the private school where I run the Scripture Knowledge Prize, which I have mentioned once or twice. The sergeant major's voice had been like a vehicle full of tin cans going over gravel, and so was this chap's. Some relation, perhaps. It was pretty dark, of course, by now, but the visibility was good enough to enable me to see that there was something else I didn't like about this creature of the night. Viz., he was shoving a whacking great shotgun against my midriff. Taken all in all, he was a bloke to be conciliated with soft speech rather than struck in the mazzard. I tried speech, keeping it as soft as I could manage without my teeth chattering. "Nice evening," I said. "I wonder if you could direct me to the village of Maiden Eggersford." And I would have gone on to explain I had been for a country ramble and lost my way. But I don't think he was listening, because all he did was bellow "Henry," presumably addressing a colleague called Henry something, and a voice that might have been that of a sergeant major's son replied,
"Yes?" "Come here."
"Where?"
"Here."
"I'm having me supper."
"Well, stop it and come here. I've cotched a chap after the horses."
He had found the right talking point. Henry was plainly a man who let nothing stand between him and his duty. When D called, he abandoned his eggs and bacon, or whatever it was, and hastened to answer the summons. And next to no time, he was with us. The big dog had disappeared. It was a dog, no doubt, with all sorts of interests, and could only give a certain amount of attention to each. Having sniffed my trouser legs and put his front paws on my chest, it felt that the time had come to seek other fields of endeavour. Henry had a torch with him, and he let it play on me.
"Go, is that him?"
"Eh."
"Nasty, slinking-looking bleeder."
"Yeah."
"He don't look half niff."
"Yeah."
"Brings to mind that old song, 'It Ain't All Violets.'"
"Lavender."
"Violets, I always thought."
"No, lavender."
"Well, have it your own way. What are you going to do with him?"
"Take him to Mr. Cook."
The prospect of another meeting with Pop Cook under such conditions, and after what had occurred between us, was naturally distasteful to me. But there seemed little I could do about it, for at that moment Henry attached himself to my collar and we moved off, his associate prodding me in the back with a gun. They took me to the house, where we were ill-received by a butler annoyed at being interrupted while smoking his off-duty pipe. He further resented being confronted with what he called tramps who smelled like something gone wrong with the drains. I don't know what I had fallen into, but it was becoming abundantly evident that it had been something rather special. The whole tone of the public's reaction to my society emphasized this. The butler was very definite about everything. No, he said, they couldn't see Mr. Cook. Were they under the impression, he asked, that Mr. Cook was wearing a gas mask? In any case, he added, even if I had been smelling like new mown hay, Mr. Cook could not be disturbed, because he had a gentleman with him. "Shut the fellow up in one of the stables, why don't you?" the butler said. And this was what my proposer and seconder decided to do. I cannot too strongly recommend those of my readers who are thinking of getting shut up in stables to abandon the idea, for there is no percentage in it. It's stuffy, it's dark, and there's nowhere to sit down except the floor. Odd squeaking noises and sinister scratching noises make themselves heard from time to time, suggesting that rats are getting up an appetite before starting to chew you to the bone. After my escort had left me, I shuffled about a good deal, with a view of finding some way of removing myself from as morale-testing a position as I had ever been since I was so high. But the only method which occurred to me was to catch a rat and train it to gnaw through the door. However, that would take time, and I was anxious to get home and go to bed. I had groped my way to the door, as I was weighing the pros and cons of this rat sequence, and automatically my mind on other things. I gave the handle a twiddle, more by way of something to do than because I expected anything to come of it. And shiver my timbers if the door didn't come open. I thought at first that my guardian angel, who had been noticeably lethargic up to this point, had taken a stiff shot of vitamin something and had become the ball of fire he ought to have been all right along. But reflection told me what must have happened. There had been confusion between the two principals, arising from inadequate planning. Each had thought the other had turned the key, with the result that it had remained unturned. It just showed how foolish it is to embark on any enterprise without first having a frank round-table conference conducted in an atmosphere of the utmost cordiality. It was difficult to think which of the two would kick himself harder when it was drawn to their attention that they had lost their Bertram. But though I was now free as the air, as you might say, I could see that it behooved me, if behooved is the word I want, to watch my step with the utmost vigilance. It would be too silly to run into Henry and the other bloke again and get bunged into durance, whatever it's called, once more. I wanted complete freedom from both of them. Probably quite decent chaps when you get to know them, but definitely not for me. The sphere of influence was no doubt confined to the stable yard and neighbourhood, so it would be safe to leave by the route I had come by. But I shrank from doing that because I would meet that mud again. The thing to do was roam about till I found the drive and go down to it to where I'd left the car. This I proceeded to do, and I had rounded the house and was crossing a lawn of sorts when something gleamed in front of me. Before I could stop myself, I had stepped into a swimming pool. It was with mixed emotions that I rose to the surface. Surprise was one of them, for I hadn't thought that Cook was the sort of fellow to have a swimming pool. Another was annoyance. I'm not accustomed to bathing with all my clothes on, though there was that occasion at the Drones when Tuppy Glossop bet me I couldn't swing across the pool by the rings, and I was reaching the last one when I found he had roped it back, causing me to fall into the fluid in correct evening costume. But oddly enough, the emotion which stood out from the mixture was one of pleasure. Left to myself, I wouldn't have indulged in these aquatic sports, but now that I was in, I was quite enjoying my dip. And there was the agreeable thought that this would do much to reduce the bouquet I was giving out. What I had needed to enable me to rejoin the human herd without exciting adverse comment had been a good rinsing. So I did not hurry to leave the pool, but floated there like a water lily, or perhaps it would be better to say like a dead fish. And I had been doing so for some minutes when there was that old familiar sound of barking in the night, and I gathered that my friend the dog had found another soulmate. I paused in my floating. I didn't like this. It suggested that Henry and his pal, the man behind the gun, were on the prowl again. What was more likely is that they had got together and compared notes about locking the door and rushed to the stable and found me conspicuously gone by my absence. I stiffened till my resemblance to a dead fish was even more striking than it had been, and I was still rigid when I heard the sound of galloping feet, as if somebody in a hurry were coming my way, and a human form splashed into the pool beside me. That this had not been an intentional move on the human form's part was made clear by his opening remark on rising to the surface. It was the word help, and I had no difficulty in recognizing the voice of Orlo Porter.
"Help!"
he repeated. "Oh, hello, Porter," I said. "Do you say help?"
"Yes."
"Can't you swim?"
"No."
"Then," I was about to say, "then surely it was rash to come bathing." But I refrained, feeling it would not be tactful. "Then he could probably do with a helping hand," I said. He said he could, and I gave him one. We're at the deep end, and I hauled him into the shallow end, where he immediately became more at ease. Spitting out perhaps a couple of pints of water, he thanked me, brokenly, as you might say, and I begged him not to mention it. "Quite a surprise meeting you like this," I said. "What are you doing in these parts, Porter?"
"Call me Orlo."
"What are you doing in these parts, Orlo? Watching owls?"
"I came to see that blasted Cook, Worcester."
"Call me Bertie."
"I came to see that blasted Cook, Bertie. You remember your advice. Approach the old child of unmarried parents after he had had dinner, you said. And the more I thought about it, the sounder the idea seemed. You really have an extraordinary flair, Bertie. You read your fellow man like a book."
"Oh, thanks. Just a matter of studying the psychology of the individual."
"Unfortunately, you can't judge someone like Cook by ordinary standards. Do you know why that is, Bertie?"
No, Orlo, why?
Because he's a hellhound, and there's no telling what a hellhound will do. Planning strategy is hopeless when you're dealing with hellhounds.
I gather that things did not go altogether as planned.
And how right you are, Bertie. The thing was a flop. It couldn't have been a worse flop if I'd been trying to get money out of a combination of Scrooge and Gaspar the Miser.
Tell me all, Orlo.
If you have a moment, Bertie.
Oh, all the time in the world, Orlo.
You don't want to hurry away somewhere.
No, I like it here.
So do I. Pleasantly cool, is it not? Well then, I arrived and told the butler I wanted to see Mr. Cook on a matter of importance, and the butler took me to the library, where I found Cook smoking a fat cigar. I was confident when I saw it that I had chosen my time right. The cigar was plainly an after-dinner cigar, and he was drinking brandy. There could be no doubt that the man was full to the back teeth. Are you following me, Bertie?
Oh, I get the picture, Orlo.
There was another man there, some sort of African explorer, I gathered.
Major Plank!
His presence was an embarrassment because he would insist on telling us all about the fertility rights of the natives of Bongo on the Congo, which, take it from me, are too improper for words. But he left us after a while, and I was able to get down to business. And a lot of good it did me. Cook refused to part with a penny.
I put a question which had been in my mind for some time. I don't say I had actually been worrying about Orlo's financial position, but it had seemed to me to need explaining. What exactly is the arrangement about your money? Surely Cook can't just hold on to it.
He can till I'm 30.
How old are you?
27.
Then in another 3 years. For the first time he showed a flash of the old Orlo Porter, who had been so anxious to tear up my insides with his bare hands. He didn't actually foam at the mouth, but I could see that he missed it by the closest margins.
But I don't want to wait another 3 years, damn it. Do you know what my insurance company pays me? A pittance, Bertie. Barely enough to keep body and soul together on. And I am a man who likes nice things. I want to branch out.
A Mayfair flat?
Yes.
Champagne with every meal?
Exactly.
Rolls Royces?
Those two.
Leaving something over, of course, to slip to the hard-up proletariat. You'd like them to have what you don't need.
There won't be anything I don't need.
It was a little difficult to know what to say. I had never talked things over with a communist before, and it came as something of a shock to find that he wasn't so fond of the hard-up proletariat as I had supposed. I thought of advising him not to let the boys at the Kremlin hear him expressing such views, but decided it was none of my business. I changed the subject. By the way, Orlo, what brought you here?
Haven't you been listening? I came to see Cook.
No, no, I mean, how did you come to fall into the pool?
I didn't know it was here.
You seem to be running very fast. What was your hurry?
I was escaping from a dog that was attacking me.
Large dog, stand-up ears?
Yes, you know it.
Ah, we've met. But it wasn't attacking you.
It sprang upon me.
Oh, just in a purely friendly spirit. It springs on everyone. That's its way of being matey. He drew a long breath of relief. It would have been longer had he not lost his footing and disappeared into the depths. I reached about for him and hauled him back up, and he thanked me. A pleasure, I said.
You have taken a weight off my mind, Bertie. I was wondering how I could get back to the safety of the inn.
I'll give you a lift in my car.
No, thank you. Now that you explain the purity of that dog's motives, I'd rather walk. By the way, Bertie, there's just one point I'd like you to clarify for me. What are you doing here?
Oh, just strolling about.
Struck me as odd that you should have been in the pool.
Oh, no, just cooling off, Orlo, just cooling off.
Oh, I see. Well, good night, Bertie.
Good night, Orlo.
I can rely on the accuracy of your information about the dog.
Completely, Orlo. His life is gentle, and the elements mixed in him just right, I said, remembering a gag of Jeeves. It was with water dripping from my person in all directions, but a song in my heart, as the expression is, that some minutes later I climbed from the pool and started to where I left the car. In addition to having a song in it, my heart ought, of course, to have been bleeding for Orlo, for I realized how long it was going to take him to get all those nice things we'd been talking about. But the ecstasy of having parted from the cat left little room for sympathy for other people's troubles. My concern for Olo was, I regret to say, about equal to his for the hard-up proletariat. All was quiet on the cook front. No sign of Henry and his pal. The dog, after fraternizing with Olo, had apparently curled up somewhere and was getting his 8 hours. I drove on. The song in my heart rose to fortissimo as I got out of the car at the door of Wee Nook, only to die away in a gurgle as something soft and furry brushed against my leg. And looking down, I saw the familiar form of the cat.